Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's performance of Rendition Monologues. The reason why we're having this performance is not to give you all bad Christmases and Eids. It's to draw your attention to the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights, which took place last week. In particular, to draw our attention to the fact that nobody should be subjected to torture or cruel and degrading treatment, and that everyone has a right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty in a fair and open court.
Eventually, the vehicle was brought to a halt. I was taken out of the car. My blindfold was removed. One of my captors turned me around. He sliced the cuffs from my wrist, gave me my suitcase and a passport, and said,
"Walk down that path there and don't turn back."
I heard the car leave and began to walk as I had been instructed. It was dark. No one was around. But as I came around a corner in the road, I came across a group of armed men. They seemed to be expecting me.
"Where is your passport?"
When they saw my German passport had no Albanian visa, they asked,
"What are you doing in Albania without the necessary authorization?"
"This is Albania."
After waiting about 2 hours, I heard a plane. I heard an American accent. I knew then I was being transferred back to the Americans. There was a white female with glasses who took pictures of my body. One of the soldiers held my penis and she took digital pictures. It took a while, about half an hour. She was one of the few Americans who ever showed me any sympathy. When she saw the injuries I had, she gasped.
"Oh my God, look at that."
Then all her mates looked at what she was pointing at and I could see the shock and horror in her eyes.
"They put me in a room. They took my stuff. They took my wallet. Everything I had. And then they blindfolded me. A few minutes later, a number of people came in making a lot of noise."
"You are in Syria now. You're not in Canada. You have to speak. Huh? You don't have a lawyer, so you have to speak."
"Yeah, okay. I'll tell you whatever misunderstanding there is. I'll be happy to clear it up."
From the first day of my imprisonment to the last, there were large speakers stationed outside the hole which would play strong noises that sounded like jet engines. One day I asked the guard, "Please, stop this noise, please."
"No. No, we want this sound to stamp itself in your memory, so that whenever you hear this sound, you'll remember why you're here."
"Just a few moments ago, something believed to be a plane crashed into the south tower of the World Trade Center. I just saw flames inside. You can see the smoke coming out of the tower. Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
That just exploded.
I just saw another plane coming in from the side.
This conflict was begun on the timing and terms of others. It will end in a way and at an hour of our choosing."
Kofod Black, director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center from 1999 until May 2002, in a statement before the 9/11 Commission.
"All I want to say is that there was before 9/11 and after 9/11. After 9/11, the gloves came off. No limits, aggressive, relentless, worldwide pursuit of any terrorist who threatens us is the only way to go."
"The US government has constructed a wide-ranging detention system for terrorism suspects and others it considers to be implicated in the war on terror. This system involves a practice known as extraordinary rendition. secret transfer of terror suspects into the custody of other states, such as Syria, Egypt, Morocco, and Jordan, where torture is a prominent feature of interrogations. This practice is also used to transfer people into US custody, where they may end up in places such as
Guantanamo Bay, Cuba,
detention centres in Iraq or Afghanistan,
or in the secret facilities outside of US territory, known as black sites, run by the CIA. After almost 5 years of denials, President Bush finally confirmed on September 6, 2006, that these black sites did in fact exist.
The system of extraordinary rendition has been used by US governments since 1995.
After September 11, 2001, this system, which used to be a small-scale interagency operation, was turned largely over to the CIA and started to be used on an unprecedented and methodical scale. In addition, after a new executive order issued in the days after 9/11, the CIA no longer had to seek permission for each and every rendition.
Because the entire program is run outside of US territory, it requires the support and assistance of other governments, including handing over prisoners, providing information to facilitate their arbitrary arrest, allowing flights to pass through controlled airspace and airports, allowing planes to land in airports en route, allowing the prisons to operate, and sometimes participating in interrogations.
Some of the nations known to have cooperated in the programme are
the United Kingdom, the Republic of Ireland, Sweden, Germany, Canada, Poland, Romania, Turkey, Cyprus, Spain, Algeria, Greece, Portugal, Uzbekistan, Italy, France, Finland, Iceland, Japan, Switzerland, Belgium, the Netherlands, Jordan, Thailand, Czech Republic, Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Libya, Fiji, Estonia, Russia, the United Arab Emirates, Malaysia, the list goes on.
Because of the secrecy surrounding the practices described, and because many victims have simply disappeared, it's difficult to estimate the scope of the program.
However, according to the most recent official figures, the United States concedes to holding 27,000 secret prisoners, without charge and without access to lawyers, in various locations, some still undisclosed, around the world, mostly in Iraq, but with significant numbers elsewhere. Over 80,000 people have been through the system since 2001.
The aim of this program is to use whatever means necessary to gather intelligence and to keep prisoners away from any judicial oversight. It's created a law-free zone in which the human rights of certain individuals have simply been erased.
Extraordinary rendition is, in the words of the European Parliament, which investigated the collusion of European states in this practice,
wholly illegal. It is a criminal act which cannot be justified under any circumstances.
I, Benjamin Mohammed, an Ethiopian citizen, currently imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where I've been since September 2004, testify as follows.
I, the undersigned Marwan Jabur, who carries the identification number 953103207, after being warned that I must tell the truth and that I would be subject to the punishment stated by the law should I not do so, state the following.
I, Khaled El-Masri of Senden, Germany, under the penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America, declare as follows.
I, Abdullah Al-Malki, a Canadian citizen of Syrian origin, after agonising about the decision to speak publicly about what happened to me, worrying about the effect on my wife and children, have decided that there is no other way to ensure the truth is exposed, that those responsible are held accountable, and that this does not happen to anyone else.
What I'm saying may not be exciting enough for you. I'm sorry, I have no emotion when talking about the past, because I've closed. You have to figure out all the emotion part. I'm kind of dead in the head. Perhaps I can work this out later. I was born in Ethiopia, and my family fled the country when the military took over in 1992. Originally, we went to the US, but I'd heard good things about the British tolerance of Africans. So I talked to my parents about moving there, and we came to London in March 1994. I applied for asylum, but my lawyers were very slow, and although I had residency, 7 years went by without a result. As a man with black skin, I felt welcome in Britain. I lived in North Kensington and went to college. However, after a few years, I developed a drug habit and started drifting nowhere. In late 2000, I started attending the Muslim Heritage Centre. I gained strength from Islam, and my new friends helped me kick my drug habit. Soon after, I left Britain to travel. I'd heard that the strict ban on drugs in Afghanistan would provide a safe haven without temptation. I arrived in July 2001. 2 months later, everything changed. I heard the Americans were planning to attack, so I went to Pakistan. But I did not immediately leave for Britain. A big mistake. I stayed for a few months, and while I was there, my passport was stolen. The situation for foreigners started to get very bad, so I finally decided I had to go home. But getting back to England without a passport was difficult. As I had fled from Ethiopia, I couldn't ask them for help, and I had no right to a British passport, so a friend from London said I could use his passport instead. On the 10th of April 2002, I was detained at Karachi Airport.
This passport is invalid.
I didn't want to get my friend in trouble, so I said I'd stolen the passport and gave a false name. That was my last day of freedom. I was held for 3 days, then transferred to a detention centre. On the 20th of April 2002, I was taken to an interrogation centre in Karachi. That is where I met the FBI. I admit that I did give a false name, but I have nothing to do with America. And I don't see what America has got to do with me. It's my right to have a lawyer. I will speak only when I have a lawyer present.
The law has changed. There are no lawyers. You can cooperate with us the easy way or the hard way.
The cells in Karachi were small, each perhaps 8 by 10 feet. This is where I had my first taste of torture. I was suspended for a week by a leather strap and could just touch the ground with my toes. I soiled myself because they only lowered me twice a day. I was given some rice and beans every second day. I just thought it would end. FBI agents came in for morning interrogations. They seemed to think that because I'd lived in the US for a short while, when I was 14, that I was planning to commit some crime on American soil.
You are an Al-Qaeda operative.
How? It's been less than 6 months since I converted to Islam. Before that, I had a drug habit.
If you don't talk to me, you're going to Jordan. We can't do what we want with you here. The Pakistanis can't do exactly what we want them to. The Arabs will deal with you.
The British talked to me in Pakistan. They said they were from MI6. They checked out my story and they said...
Look, we know that you're a nobody.
They gave me a cup of tea with a lot of sugar in it. I initially only took one.
No, you need a lot more. Where you're going, you'll need a lot of sugar. Looks like you're going to get tortured by the Arabs.
We'll see what we can do with the Americans, eh? And let you know what's going to happen.
They never came back. I've struggled with how I came to mean such a lot to them. I've picked up that there was another Brit who'd been abused and was telling all kinds of things. This may have been someone I met who started putting my name in things. I don't know who it was saying all this. I wish I did.
US Attorney General John Ashcroft, 10th of June, 2002.
We have disrupted an unfolding terrorist plot to attack the US by exploding a radioactive dirty bomb. I commend the FBI, the CIA and other agencies involved in capturing Abdullah al-Mahaji.
Otherwise known as Jose Patilla. a US citizen.
Before he could act on his deadly plan.
On June the 13th, 2002, the Bush administration leaked the name of Padilla's alleged accomplice.
A man called Benjamin Mohammed, who lived in England before the plot.
Padilla, whom I've never met. And I, whose name is Binyam, not Benjamin, apparently planned to buy some uranium somewhere in Asia, smuggle it in our suitcases into the US, and explode it among the millions of innocent people living in Manhattan. I refused to talk until I had a lawyer. Then I was turned over to the Americans.
I fled Lebanon in 1985 during the Civil War and sought asylum in Germany. And in 1995, I took up German citizenship. My first marriage ended in divorce, and I remarried in 1996. Together, we have four young children. I trained as a carpenter. Then I began working as a truck driver and then a car salesman. In late 2003, I was made redundant. My wife and I started experiencing marital problems, made worse by our living conditions. Six of us were all living in a one-room apartment. By December that year, things had become so bad that I felt I just had to leave home for a while, you know, to get my head together. So a friend suggested that I buy a cheap bus ticket to Macedonia. The bus left Ulm as scheduled on December the 30th, 2003. We travelled without incident through Germany, Austria, Slovenia, Croatia and Serbia. Around 3 p.m. on New Year's Eve 2003, the bus arrived at the border between Serbia and Macedonia. After our papers were checked, everyone, except me, had their passport returned to them. The bus driver approached me and asked me to get off the bus and meet with a border official. A fellow traveller translated for me.
Where are you going to stay in Macedonia?
I intend to find a hotel when I arrive. I have no specific hotel in mind.
What is the purpose of your trip?
I'm here as a tourist. I plan to stay for a week.
As soon as you arrive in Macedonia, you should go and see the local police. You can go back on the bus now.
The bus driver stayed with him for a few minutes before returning to the bus, and then we headed off. After a short while, I asked the bus driver if he could return my passport.
I don't have it. It must still be with the border officials.
He turned the bus around and went back to the border.
There is a problem with your passport, and resolving it might take some time. After we have resolved it, I will drop you off at the hotel in town.
The bus drove on without me. After a few hours, I was taken to a room.
Put every item you're carrying with you on the table.
He searched everything thoroughly. Then a young man started interrogating me, asking me about Islamic organisations.
Do you know any of these organisations?
I have heard of most of them.
Do you have anything to do with them?
I have no involvement or contact with any of them.
Where you live? Are there any mosques? How many people attend the services there? What are their nationalities? Have you ever invited someone to Islamic activities at the mosque? Has anyone invited you?
This interrogation ended several hours later at 10 p.m. By this stage, some of the officers were drunk. In less than 2 hours, New Year would begin. I was taken by armed escorts to a hotel in town and into a room on the top floor. After entering the room, three of the escorts remained with me.
Why don't you leave? We're going to stay with you.
Am I under arrest?
Do you see any handcuffs on your wrists?
The watch was divided between nine men. They changed every 6 hours. On the fifth day, a man appeared with a bag. He had sheets of paper and fingerprint ink. He took a few photographs of me. On the seventh day, another official arrived who appeared to be of much higher rank than any of my guards.
How are you feeling? Is the food okay? You can order food from the restaurant if you don't like the food they're giving you.
Thank you. So far, I'm fine.
I want to end this situation for you, and I can. I have a deal to offer you.
What kind of deal?
If you admit to belong to Al-Qaeda, we will send you back to Germany with a police escort.
I refused. A few days later, his assistant turned up.
This is a list of the allegations against you. We are certain they're true. Based on these allegations, your case is no longer within our control.
I would like to meet with the German ambassador or any other German authority.
The German government don't want anything to do with you. Your passport does not belong to you, and you've been seen in Afghanistan.
She showed me a picture of an Arab-looking guy who said he had seen me in Afghanistan and knew me.
This man is waiting outside in the corridor.
Bring him in, then. They didn't bring anybody in. On the 13th day, I started a hunger strike to protest my situation. A week later, they told me they would soon send me to the airport to fly me back to Germany. On the 23rd day of my captivity, a video recording was taken of me.
State your full name. Say that you've been treated well and that you will shortly be flown back to Germany.
I did this and was then accompanied out of the hotel. Once outside, two men approached me and handcuffed and blindfolded me and put me in a vehicle.
I live in Ottawa, Canada, with my wife and six children. I was born in Syria. I came to Canada when I was 16 and became a Canadian citizen. While I was studying engineering, I became interested in development and worked on reconstruction projects with Human Concern International in the southern part of Afghanistan and in Pakistan. In 1994, my wife and I went back to work on a project, but I had disagreements with the director, so we returned home earlier than we planned. The director's name was Ahmad Akaba. I didn't realise until many years later what my acquaintance with him would mean. We started our family and also started an exports business. The business went very well and expanded quickly. I travelled a lot to the US, Asia and the Middle East. In the summer of 1998, I received a phone call.
Mr. Alf Malky?
Yes?
Teresa Sullivan from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service.
Oh, what can I do for you?
I'd like to meet with you, ask you a few questions.
I met her at a coffee shop a few days later.
Do you sell equipment to the Taliban?
No.
Have you had military training?
No.
Do you know any of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan?
No. I also mentioned my previous work in Afghanistan and Pakistan and mentioned Mr. Kader. She seemed surprised. In the end, I asked, why do you want to talk to me?
Don't worry. We do these types of interviews randomly.
A few months later, she asked me to speak with her again. This time, she asked about Mr. Kader. As I told you before, I barely know him.
Mr. Kader has been tied to a wanted terrorist named Osama bin Laden. I want to know more about their relationship.
I don't know anything about it. After that, I noticed that every single package that was shipped to my business had been opened and resealed with customs tape. A man I knew told me that Canadian intelligence had asked him to go into my house and look for bomb-making equipment. I started hearing from people in the Muslim community that they were being questioned about me. Then I discovered my bank account was being monitored and my mail was being intercepted. But Canadian intelligence didn't contact me again until September 2001.
The Canadian intelligence community came under intense pressure after 9/11. US agencies were provided with copies of the 26 hard drives, hundreds of CDs, and thousands of documents that the Canadian police had seized in raids, but did not have the manpower to analyse themselves.
On September 18, 2001, a Canadian intelligence agent came to my house to question me. After that, my wife and I noticed that cars seemed to be following us wherever we went. Sometimes it was five or six vehicles at a time. A camera was installed opposite our home, and visitors were followed when they left our house. By late November, it had become too much for us, and I took my family for a holiday to Malaysia to see my wife's mother, who was ill. While I was there, the Canadian police searched my parents' house while they were visiting family in Syria. When my brothers went to check on the house, they found it ransacked. Numerous items and documents have been seized. Then my brothers were questioned by Canadian police, who came to their houses early in the morning.
We're questioning you because we suspect that your brother Abdullah sold computer equipment to companies in Pakistan, which have in turn sold it to others, and that the equipment eventually made it into the hands of terrorists.
I took a business trip to Saudi Arabia. As it is very close to Syria, I decided to go and see my grandmother, who was sick. My parents, who were there at the time, came to meet me at Damascus Airport. My mother and I embraced. Then, an immigration officer came in and asked me to go with him into a room where there were three officers. They pulled out a report.
We received this report about you from an embassy a couple of weeks ago.
Once I heard the word embassy, I knew it was something not only related to Syria, but also something more international. I was taken into a detention room and questioned. They said I was wanted in the Palestine branch. We drove in a van through Damascus. When we got out of the van, I tipped the men who had carried my luggage. Everything had been very friendly until then.
Take what you need from your bag.
How long will I need things for?
3 days.
I was shocked, but I thought that once I spoke with someone in charge, they would let me go. They put me in a room. They took my stuff. They took my wallet. Everything I had. Then they blindfolded me. A few minutes later, a number of people came in, making a lot of noise.
You are in Syria now. You are not in Canada. You have to speak. You don't have a lawyer, so you have to speak.
Yeah, okay. I'll tell you whatever misunderstanding there is. I'll be happy to clear it up.
What have you been doing in Canada? And what are you planning to do? Why are the Canadians, the Americans, the British, the whole world interested in you?
I don't know. And that's when, all of a sudden, from nowhere, I got a slap on the face. That changed everything. I had never been slapped before. It just transferred me from one world to another. With that slap, he took my humanity away. And things got much worse from that point on.
I am from a family of Palestinian refugees from Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. Later in life, I moved to Pakistan to study computer engineering. I did not belong to any party, nor was I religious. But because of some difficult events I had lived through, two of my friends were killed in car accidents, and my doctor told me I was suffering a liver infection and that my days were numbered, I decided to go to the mosque and pray and get closer to Islam. In 1998, when the Russians in Chechnya were killing over 300,000 Muslims, people and religious leaders were discussing jihad in Chechnya, alongside many Arab governments. I decided to go there for jihad. Someone told me that the Mujahideen there only accepted trained members. So I started going to Kabul in Afghanistan to train in combat and operating weapons. The camp was operated and funded by the Taliban government. They offered training for everyone, and not only from an extremist religious perspective. Over 3 months, I was trained to use a pistol and a Kalashnikov. By the time I had finished training, the Russians had taken over Chechnya, and it was too dangerous for Arabs. So I returned to Pakistan in order to continue my studies. A few months later, I married a Pakistani girl. After the events of September 11, 2001, the US declared a crusade against Afghanistan. So I decided to participate in the war with the Taliban in order to protect Afghanistan as a Muslim country and not Al-Qaeda. I went there and joined a Taliban group numbering 300 people. But with the rising bombardments and pressure from the locals, Afghan warriors opposed to the Taliban took control of the city I was in, and thus I went back to Pakistan without fighting. In those days, the security situation in Pakistan was very difficult, especially for non-Pakistanis. Because I carried a Pakistani passport due to my marriage,
I started renting apartments for Arab families leaving Afghanistan and organising medical assistance for them. Their health was very grave because of the time they had spent in caves and mountains. Many of them had gunshot wounds. Some were in critical conditions. A Yemenite with a stab wound to his head. A Turkish man whose legs were severed. A Yemenite man I had met while training in Kabul gave me money for the families, and I was helping them on a voluntary basis. I felt responsible for them and agreed to help them on the condition that they did not belong to any organisation. In November 2003, I received a text message. It said, "Arriving tomorrow." My wife received it too. We were both worried. I sent a message to this number and tried calling it, but in vain. I said to my wife, "I better be away from home." After an hour, I left. She called me.
"The Pakistani intelligence came and searched the house and took all the electronic devices, passports, ID cards, your academic diplomas, your birth certificate, and the money for the families, about $10,000.
Pakistan has detained more than 900 people in the name of the war on terrorism. America has been paying the ISI, Pakistan's feared intelligence service, a bounty for each important terrorist suspect they hand over.
I escaped to Lahore and my wife joined me after a while. She was pregnant, and after she gave birth, she was arrested and beaten by the Pakistani intelligence, who questioned her for 2 days about my whereabouts. They beat her even though she had just given birth. On the 9th of May 2004, as I was leaving a friend's house, Pakistani intelligence arrested me along with my friend. I was put in a car, handcuffed, and they covered my head with a ragged bag. Through the bag, I could see they were taking us to the Lahore interrogation centre and into a room where five or six men started beating me with wooden and electrifying sticks.
The US soldiers who took me, six or seven of them, they were dressed in black.
They were wearing black uniforms and
black masks.
They cut off my clothes.
I was beaten severely from both sides.
They stripped me naked, took photos, put fingers up my anus.
I felt a stick or some other hard object being forced into my anus.
They dressed me in a
dark blue
tracksuit.
I was dressed in a diaper.
They put diapers under my pants.
I was shackled
and blindfolded.
I was tied to a seat in an aeroplane for the roughly 8 to 10 hour flight.
I was thrown onto the floor of an aeroplane and my arms and legs were spread-eagled and secured to the sides of the plane. During the flight, I received
two injections.
I was mostly unconscious for the duration of the flight. We landed at an airport somewhere. When I was taken out of the plane, I could feel warm, dry air, and I knew immediately that the place where the plane had landed couldn't possibly be Europe.
I was certainly not back in England.
When the plane landed, I was injected with something which made me wake up. We drove for an hour, and I was taken to a building. No one talked to me the entire time.
Nobody said a word.
They didn't talk. The whole time they communicated in sign language.
That slap was the most painful thing emotionally. But then the physical pain became way more severe.
Abdullah was being held in Syria's most feared interrogation centre and a key destination in the war on terror. In January 2002, President Bush had declared an axis of evil consisting of Iran, Iraq and North Korea. In May, the US State Department, which had been condemning the regime's use of torture for years, added Syria as a candidate on the list.
"Lie down on the floor, put your legs up."
So I'm lying on the floor, stomach down, legs up, hands behind my back, my cheek on the floor, and then all of a sudden, the closest thing that I could think of really to describe it was someone pouring lava on my soles. I flicked from the pain. I just flicked and grabbed my legs. Of course, during all that time, it's insults, calling me names, kicking me. So they got me back down. But now, so that I don't flip again, one guy stood over my head, one guy stood over my back, and the others were kicking me with their wooden-soled shoes, and another guy was beating my soles with the cables he had. Later, a few interrogators told me that I was given 1,000 lashes on the first day I got there. That means 7 or 8 hours of beatings.
I soon realised I was in Morocco and interrogations began. The British knew what was happening because they supplied information about my life in the UK for the sessions. I sought asylum in Britain rather than America because it's known as the one country that has laws that it follows. To say that I was disappointed at this moment would be an understatement. I knew I was going to be tortured. After a few days, I was taken to a room.
This is just talk. If you want interrogation, we'll interrogate you.
They asked me about my life, about Moroccan groups in Afghanistan. I said, I don't know anything about these groups.
You had better speak to us now.
I know I'm here to be tortured, so you may as well get on with it. I've nothing to do with you, or your Moroccan groups, as I'm not Moroccan. They left me all day to think about it. Nothing happened. Then a lady came in.
My name is Sarah. I'm a Canadian. You can think of me as a third party. Because you refused to talk to the Moroccans and the Americans, maybe talking to a Canadian would be better. If you don't talk to me, then the Americans will torture you. They're going to electrocute you, beat you, rape you.
I never asked for a third party. I asked for a lawyer. I will not talk.
You don't know what's good for you. I'm giving you a last chance to think about cooperating with the US.
How can I talk to them? I know nothing about what they want. That night, 3 men came in with black masks and beat me. It seemed to go on for hours. The hands that were hitting me looked like the hands of someone who had worked as a mechanic or chopped with an axe. After they left, I lapsed into unconsciousness. When I awoke, I saw that I'd vomited, pissed on myself. This circle of torture was to last another 18 months.
After adjusting my eyes to the light, I could see that I was lying in a small, filthy concrete cell. I was very thirsty and asked one of the guards for some water. He pointed to a small bottle in the corner of my cell, a very old plastic bottle. The colour of the water was greenish-brown. I could smell it from the other side of the cell. When I tried to drink it, it caused me to vomit. I was worrying a lot about my family. My wife didn't know her way around home very well, and the kids were very small. Before I left, my wife and I had a big argument. These things were going through my head all the time.
Khalid's wife had no idea where he was. She spoke little German and had no German friends. She could not understand how cruel Khalid could be not to call or send a postcard. She decided to go back to Lebanon and stay with her parents and sold the family car to pay for the flight.
The prison Khalid was held in was called the Salt Pit, an abandoned brick factory in Kabul, Afghanistan, one of a network of prisons which was controlled by the CIA. Afghan guards ran the place, and the interrogations were carried out by Americans who used interpreters.
I was dragged again and again into the interrogation room. They were screaming at me.
Do you know why you have been detained?
No, no, that is my question to you.
You are in a land where there are no laws. Do you know what that means? We can bury you or keep you in this prison for 20 years and nobody on earth would ever know. This file contains evidence that you attended a terrorist training camp here in Afghanistan and that your passport is forged.
If you wish to determine whether that evidence is correct, then you should speak with the German authorities, who will prove that I am a German citizen and that I have never been to Pakistan or Afghanistan. Why have I been taken here? I have no ties to this country.
One of the interrogators tied my genitals with a rubber band so that I could not pee. It caused me great pain and I fainted a lot. They asked me about certain people, some I knew, others not. They asked me where the safe houses were, and to call people whose names were in my mobile phone. At first, I denied that the mobile was mine,
I refused to call them or give the addresses of the safe houses which I said I knew nothing about. I said I was just a student. They cursed and spat at me and then took a heated piece of iron, which I think is used to heat water, and he burned my left hand and leg, where the burn marks are still visible today. The interrogation continued in this manner for 3 days, and I was not allowed to sleep. On the third day, I had a heart attack. I was allowed a doctor and allowed to sleep for 4 hours before the interrogations began again. On the fourth day, they tried a friendly method. They untied me and let me talk to my mother on the phone. When I refused to cooperate, he cursed my mother, and they tied me up again and began beating me. Then I met some Americans.
Marwan, you're at a crossroads. We know what torture you went through in recent days, so either you cooperate with us, and then you'll be one of the richest and happiest people in the world and live a beautiful life with your family wherever you want, or you prepare yourself to die in a solitary hole, where many American men like the one standing here are waiting for you and asking about you.
I am an innocent man. I have no information that could help you.
Someone in Guantanamo mentioned you. He knows you. Hassan al-Jul.
I had met him once but did not know which organisation he belonged to. I denied knowing him.
They kept asking me the same questions while beating me day after day.
You sold equipment. Tell us what equipment you sold to the Taliban.
I have had absolutely no dealings with them.
You are an assistant to Osama bin Laden.
No, I am not.
No, you are his right-hand man.
How can I be? Everybody knows who his right-hand man is.
Then you are his left-hand man.
Fine, I'm his left-hand man. After this, they stopped beating me.
When did you meet for the first time?
When I was working in Pakistan. That satisfied them for a few minutes. They left. They came back.
You're lying. Don't play with us. He was in Sudan at that time. How could you have met him?
On day 3, my body was stuffed into a tire and completely restrained. They started beating me on the soles of my feet, head and body, and also struck me on my genitals.
After this, it's going to be the chair, then electricity, and now pulling.
It was a constant fear that I would not survive. Multiple times they told me that they were getting their information from Canada. One time, I remember it specifically, an interrogator told me...
You know what? I knew you better than your wife, your mum, your father. And I know that you've not done anything wrong. But the information we're getting from the Canadian says otherwise.
I was kept in a cell, which was very cold and dark. It was about 6 feet long, 34 inches wide, just over 6.5 feet tall. The other prisoners used to call it the grave. Back wall of the cell was covered in condensation, which dripped down the wall and made the blanket on the floor wet. There were 2 containers for food, a bottle for urine, and 3 blankets. There were rats, which came in under the door, walked over my legs while I was trying to sleep, and giant cockroaches everywhere. My cell and blankets were full of lice and other blood-sucking insects. I lived in that cell for 482 days.
I couldn't work out what they wanted to hear.
Give me the whole story all over again.
I did what I could.
If this is the best you can come up with, you haven't seen anything yet. Someone in Al-Qaeda has said you're a big man, so we figure it must be true.
He called 3 goons in. He stood behind them watching while they beat me. He was just standing there watching, smoking cigarettes like the Godfather in the film. He just gave an order.
Ijabu.
This means beat him. I guess this went on for a couple of his cigarettes. After a while I said to him, I've got no problem saying whatever you want me to say.
That's good. When I say something, you say yes.
But then it would get to me. He thought he was something doing all this. He thought he was something smart. I made a mistake. I said, you're not intelligence, you're Moroccan. The British have intelligence, you don't. That night he came back with 3 thugs.
Strip him and tie him to the wall.
I tried to put on a brave face as they took a scalpel to my right chest. It was only a small cut, maybe an inch. At first I just screamed because the pain was just... I was just shocked. I wasn't expecting. Then they cut my left chest. This time I didn't scream because I knew it was coming. The interrogator got agitated at this.
Just go ahead with the plan.
One of them took my penis in his hand and began to make cuts. He did it once, and they stood still for maybe a minute, watching my reaction. I was in agony, trying desperately to suppress myself, but I was screaming. They must have done this 20 to 30 times in maybe 2 hours. There was blood all over. Once they began this, they'd do it to me about once a month. There were even worse things, too horrible to remember, let alone talk about.
In March, together with several other inmates with whom I had been communicating by whispering through the door and exchanging messages on pieces of toilet paper, I started a hunger strike. We refused to eat or drink until we could see an American commander or representative. After 27 days without food, feeling close to death, I was taken to an interrogation room and met with two unmasked Americans.
Why are you on hunger strike?
I am protesting my abduction from Macedonia and my detention in Afghanistan. My continued detention without charge or trial. Your refusal to allow me access to a lawyer, my family, or my government, and the inhuman conditions of my confinement.
I want you to end your hunger strike. I believe you're not a terrorist and that you do not belong here.
You can choose between four options. You can release me, bring me before a court, or give me immediate access to a German government official. The only other circumstance that would bring an end to my hunger strike is my death.
I will take this matter up with my superiors in Washington, but I can't release you without their authorization.
My health deteriorated daily. By April 8th, I was so weak that I was unable to leave my bed, not even to use the toilet. One night, 37 days into the strike, hooded men entered my cell, dragged me from my bed and bound my hands and feet, sat me in a chair and tied me to it. One of the men grabbed my head and a tube was stuffed up my nose and some sort of liquid was forced directly into my stomach. I was weighed. I had lost more than 60 pounds.
We can do it this way every time. You cannot force us to follow your wishes.
So we negotiated. They promised to give us better food and better water and some books.
After 2 months in the Palestine branch, I was taken to an outdoor courtyard for 20 minutes. I had not seen the sun in those 2 months. My skin was turning yellow, and I was covered in lice bites. I took my blankets with me and laid them on the ground in the sun. This was the first time I was able to see what they looked like and how dirty they were. There was yellow and black mold growing on them. I started walking, and then I tried to run around the yard, but I kept stumbling. I was not able to open my eyes fully because of the glare. Once my eyes had adjusted, I looked up at the sky and saw a jasmine plant above the fence. I remember marvelling at how beautiful it was.
I was taken by the Americans to a camp. I had no idea what country I was in. They put me in a solitary hole by people in black masks and black uniforms who severely tortured me. I was kept completely naked for the first 3 months. The shackles on my feet were not removed once in the first year and 3 months. I was held at the camp for over 2 years, and for the extent of my detainment, I did not see the sunlight or the sky.
I never went outside. I never saw the sun, not even once. I never saw any human being except the guards and my tormentors.
The hole was 1 meter by 2 meters and did not have a window, a mattress, sink, or toilet. There was a bucket, a blanket, and a speaker and a camera. The camera worked 24 hours a day, and the speaker was used to play music and other noise at high volume for 2 days or 4 days when they wanted to punish me. From the first day of my imprisonment to the last, the speakers would play strong noises that sounded like jet engines. One day I asked the interrogator, "Please, stop this noise, please."
"No! No, no, we want this sound to stamp itself into your memory so that whenever you hear the sound, you will remember why you're here."
Marwan was being held in one of a network of covert CIA prisons, often referred to as black sites, which have operated in several countries since the 9/11 attacks. The locations are known to only a handful of officials in the United States, and usually only to the president and a few top intelligence officers in each host country.
In mid-July, the Syrian interrogators started torturing me daily again and accusing me of lying to them. I told them I had told you the truth and everything I know. This type of thing went on every two or three days for a couple more months.
Sometimes an interrogator would put me in a closet called the dog box.
They put drugs in my food, injected me with drugs. About once a month they would do other things to me that I just cannot talk about. I think I came to several emotional breakdowns in this time. But who was there to turn to?
In September, I was questioned about an acquaintance, Maher Arar. I learned that Maher came to the attention of Canadian intelligence services when he and I had lunch at the Mango Cafe in Ottawa in October 2001. His wife was having a baby, and my brother, whom he worked with, suggested he ask me, because I had four children at the time, if I could recommend a good doctor to see. In October, Maher ended up in the Palestine branch and spent 10 months in a cell near mine.
At the turn of the millennium, criticism of torture seemed to be almost universal. When the occasional tale of torture leaked out from a repressive regime, there was unanimous condemnation. Then came September the 11th, 2001.
Condoleezza Rice, US Secretary of State, December 2005.
Renditions take terrorists out of action and save lives. In conducting such renditions, it is the policy of the United States to comply with its laws and comply with its treaty obligations, including those under the Convention Against Torture. The United States has not transported anyone and will not transport anyone to a country where we believe he will be tortured. Where appropriate, the United States seeks assurances that transferred persons will not be tortured.
Clive Stafford Smith, a British lawyer who represents numerous prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, many of whom are also victims of the rendition program.
I mean, that is unadulterated bullshit. I don't mean to disrespect Ms. Rice, but at the same time, what she is saying is nonsense. I've seen the scars, and I've seen the flight logs, and anyone who says that my clients are lying should take a look at those.
Stephen Gray, British journalist and author of Ghost Plane, a book about the rendition programme.
None of the 90 cases of rendition I cover in my book have been proven to be involved in acts of terrorism, and the whole point is that they are not brought to trial. None of them. I'm not saying they're not terrorists. I don't know. I just happen to believe that the way to test evidence against people is to bring them to trial and let's hear the evidence.
Lawrence Wilkerson, previously Chief of Staff to former US Secretary of State Colin Powell, and who served in the US military for more than 30 years.
We are using a very unsophisticated tool to detain these people, and we have no sophisticated tools to vet them. We've detained, at my last count, some 30, 40, 50,000 people, yet I would maintain that 85% of these people were totally innocent. They were not in any way insurgents, they were not in any way terrorists, they were not in any way high-value terrorists.
In 2005, an American Human Rights Watch delegation met with the Prime Minister of Egypt and raised a case in which hundreds of prisoners rounded up after a terrorist bombing were tortured by Egyptian security forces. The Prime Minister didn't deny the charge,
He only said,
"We're just doing what the United States does."
Finally, in January 2004, I was taken cuffed and blindfolded to a plane. I heard an American accent. I knew then that I was being transferred then back to the Americans. There was a white female with glasses who took pictures of my body. One of the soldiers held my penis and she took digital pictures. This took a while, maybe half an hour. She was one of the few Americans who ever showed me any sympathy. When she saw the injuries I had, she gasped.
"Oh my God, look at that."
Then all her mates looked at what she was pointing at, and I could see the shock and horror in her eyes. I ended up in Kabul in a place called the Prison of Darkness and stayed there for 5 months. It was pitch black and no lights on in the rooms for most of the time. After a while, I didn't feel I existed at all. Plenty of prisoners lost their minds. I could hear people knocking their heads against the walls and the doors, screaming their heads off. Well, what a time to believe in God. Without hope, I would certainly have been dead. In May, we were tied like hens going for slaughter, thrown into a helicopter, and transferred to Bagram Air Base. I was allowed to see the International Committee of the Red Cross for the first time in my life, sometime in late May or June 2004. I don't remember the actual date. The official said,
"Oh, we can't publicise anything because we've got this agreement with the US government to keep everything quiet."
I was then taken to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in September 2004, where I remain to this day.
Finally, I was taken to see an American who questioned me, and then a German man who called himself Sam. On May 28th, I was taken to an airport, blindfolded and chained to a seat in a plane. When the plane landed, I was bundled into a van. Eventually, the vehicle was brought to a halt. I was taken out of the van, and before my blindfold was removed, one of my captors turned me around. He then removed the blindfold, sliced the cuffs off my wrist, gave me my suitcase and a passport, and said,
"Walk down that path there and don't turn back."
I heard the car leave, and I began to walk as I was instructed. It was dark. No one was around. But as I walked around the corner, I met some armed men. They seemed to be expecting me.
"Where is your passport?"
When they saw that my German passport had no Albanian visa, they asked,
"What are you doing in Albania without the necessary authorization?"
"This is Albania." Something has happened to me. I was arrested in Macedonia. Then Americans, the CIA, they took me to a prison in Afghanistan. Then after 5 months, I was brought here.
CIA, huh? I wouldn't tell that story to anyone if I was you. No one will believe you. Just keep it to yourself.
They drove me to Mother Teresa Airport in Tirana. One of the men took my passport and took some money from my wallet, went into the airport building and bought me a ticket. I boarded an ordinary civilian flight. Only after the plane was airborne did I finally believe I was going home. At Frankfurt Airport, the immigration officer said,
"Are you the same man as the man in the picture? You look completely different."
I showed him some other identity documents and he let me through. I knew before I entered my house that no one was there and that no one had been there for several months. The mailbox was stuffed and there were threatening letters from bill collectors. The entire apartment had been ransacked. The sofa was ripped apart. I found out where my wife was and I called her. And she returned a week later. When I was finally reunited with my family, I told them what had happened to me. My life has changed in every aspect. I'm really not the person I was before.
I was transferred to the interrogation branch of the Syrian military intelligence, and the torture continued. It was different, though. The torture was short and intense, and they did not want information. Sometime in January, I was taken to an office. My mother, father, and another relative came in the room and were shocked at what they saw. My father said he was hopeful that I would be released soon. Honestly, I do not think that I was going to be released because I got to a state where I was totally hopeless. 1 year, 7 months, and 10 days after being first detained, I was released. My relatives were waiting in the general's office. My mother looked about 20 years older than the day I saw her at the airport. My father was in a terrible shape. But, yeah, I was happy. The general said,
"I'm sorry you were not released earlier. Syria is under a lot of pressure to cooperate in the fight against terrorism."
As soon as I was able to go, I got on the first flight to Europe. It was to Vienna, where I was reunited with my wife. We spent some time together before leaving for Canada and arriving home on August 22nd, 2004. It's a daily struggle now. I have a displaced eardrum. I have a displaced jaw. I have chronic pain in my shoulder, my hip and my feet. The doctor is telling me that soon arthritis will be all over my joints because of the long period I spent sleeping on the floor. I'm treated by a psychiatrist for post-traumatic stress disorder and severe depression.
After a year of detainment, they would take me out of the hole to watch a documentary film, which I would choose out of a list of American films. They also let me choose from a list of books that were in the library, and then gave me a DVD player and some DVDs. In the last months, they gave me an electronic chessboard. After 2 years, they would place me in a hall where I could see the sunlight, and I was allowed to have a divider between the guards and me while I showered. On the 29th of July 2006, one of the clerks said,
"I have good news for you."
"What news?"
"Tomorrow you'll be transferred from there."
"Where to?"
"I don't know. Bring all your stuff."
We drove to the airport, and I was put somewhere to wait. I heard noises like a cocking a weapon and thought, "This is the end. I'm going to be killed." But I was put on a plane, and when they removed my blindfold, I was surprised to see pictures of King Hussein and King Abdullah hanging on the wall in front of me. I was in Jordan. The interrogation here lasted a month and a half. I just wrote down everything I told the Americans. I was able to write to my wife and children and tell them that I was alive. The Red Cross visited me here, and the representative got in touch with my family. On the 18th of September 2006, they said to me,
"Congratulations, Marwan. Today you will be released."
They took me to a room on King Hussein Bridge, which connects Jordan and Israel. Then handed me over to the Israelis, where I was brought before a judge and released after 6 weeks. 2.5 years after I was arrested, I was finally able to speak to my wife and children on the phone.
Maha Arar, Canadian citizen who was rendered to Syria, testifying in the US congressional hearing, September 2007.
"I would have believed this was an innocent mistake if it was not happening to others. There seems to be a pattern where hundreds of others are being sent to countries to be tortured. We now know the information the Americans have is false. But even if it was true, this does not justify sending me to Syria."
Dana Rohrabacher, Republican congressman, in response.
"Mr. Arar, you are a father. You have children."
"Yes."
"How many children do you have?"
"I have two, a daughter and a son."
"How old are they?"
"My daughter is 10 years old and my son is 5 years old."
"Right. Now, I have three children and they are all grown. My life was blessed with grandchildren. Triplets. 3.5 years ago, one boy and two girls.
And I would hope that whatever our government does, that your children are safe and that my children are safe. We established different operations because we knew at that time there were people who were willing to kill tens of thousands of human beings because they hate our way of life. We are at war, and I do not want to let go of 50 terrorists who will go out and plant a bomb in London and kill 20,000 people in order to protect that one person who we arrested accidentally because his name was the same or because he went to a mosque and didn't know this thing was going on in the back room. I'm afraid that's the price we pay in a real world. The US... Yeah, we're not ghouls. We're not. We don't torture somebody because he has a bad name. We want to get information from somebody that we think might want to kill our children and kill your children. I know there are a lot of people who hate America, but when the pressure's on, America has to go it alone.
Tom Milanovsky, Human Rights Watch, Washington.
Imagine the secret police in China or Burma accused an American of supporting the rebels in their country, and on that basis kidnapped that American off the streets of Indianapolis, bundled him on a plane, and held him for years in a secret facility. Or, just for the sake of argument, imagine if the president of Russia declared that his country was engaged in a global war on terror, and that anyone with any connection to any group that supported separatist elements in places like Chechnya was a combatant in that war, who could be detained, or shot, or poisoned, wherever he was found, whether in Moscow or Berlin, or, just for the sake of argument, London. Clearly, we live in a world where such things are possible. But do we want to live in a world where they are considered legitimate? That is what is at stake here. The United States is the most influential country on the face of the earth. It is a standard setter in everything it does, for better or for worse.
In the 6 years since September 11, no victim of this program has had their treatment acknowledged by the US government, nor have they received any compensation from the US government.
While at Guantanamo Bay, Binyam Mohammed was one of the 10 prisoners whose cases were chosen to be heard in a hastily constructed military commission, which the US Supreme Court was soon to declare illegal. After his 4-year ordeal, this was the first and last time Binyam was able to speak publicly. He said to the judge,
"This is not a commission, it's a con mission. A mission to con the world. And that's what it is, you understand? You can execute me tomorrow, but don't try and cheat the world of what this really is. This place has got great implications. You start playing around with commissions, you start here, and tomorrow we have another one in Canada, the next day we have another in Australia, and the next day we have it in another place, where certain non-citizens have to obey some rule that just got made up."
Despite repeated assurances from the Bush administration that the men held in Guantanamo Bay were
people picked up off the battlefield in Afghanistan,
the worst of the worst,
among the most dangerous, best-trained, vicious killers on the face of the earth,
involved in an effort to kill thousands of Americans,
it is now clear that the vast majority of the prisoners who have been and still are held there were not taken into custody in Afghanistan by US troops, but, like Binyam and Marwan, were handed over by the Pakistanis and Northern Alliance, usually in exchange for large bounties. It has also been discovered that the vast majority of them were not even accused of being Al-Qaeda, let alone proven guilty.
In February 2008, Binyam's sister Zuhra, an American citizen, emailed the British Foreign Secretary, David Miliband.
"Good evening, Mr. Miliband. I beg you to please review Binyam Mohammed's case in Guantanamo. I can't even sleep thinking about how he is being treated
and not knowing what he has endured. I hope the world would understand him like we, his family, do. It's hard sometimes, the thoughts that cross our minds. And now they're telling us that he is in meltdown, close to suicide. I would like to hug him and hold him, like all the rest of his family. Please, let it not be too late. Please, you are the only person I have written to, but you are my only hope. Please, please help us.
In a letter to Prime Minister Gordon Brown in May 2008, Binyang concluded,
I have been held without trial by the US for 6 years, 1 month and 12 days. That is 2,234 days. Very long days and often longer nights. Still, there is no end in sight, no prospect of a fair trial. It's long past time to end this matter. I've been next to committing suicide this past while. That would be one way to end it, I suppose.
On the 3rd of June 2008, the Pentagon finally announced that it was charging British resident Binyam Mohammed in the quasi-legal military commissions on allegations surrounding the long-discredited dirty bomb plot. Charges which were described as implausible, even by senior Bush administration figures, and were dropped against Binyam's alleged accomplice, Mr. Padilla, who had the benefit of a civilian court.
I believe in American justice. I want to know why this was done to me. I want an explanation and an apology. This is how you establish an international dictatorial regime. They trample on freedom and justice, on values and morals with their feet. And you have to keep quiet because you're a threat to international and national security? Is this an argument? I will continue to fight for this case until we prevail. Until I die.
Khaled has had no help after his ordeal, despite appeals for treatment to psychiatrists and to the government. He feared he was losing his mind. In May 2007, after being cooped up in his apartment and living in constant fear that his children would be harmed, he was committed to a mental institution for an indefinite period after setting fire to a shopping mall. He has suffered a complete breakdown.
On October 9, 2007, the US Supreme Court decided that it would not hear Khaled's case. They offered no explanation. The decision effectively endorses White House arguments that allowing Khaled to proceed with his case would compromise state secrets.
Lord Hoffman, when rejecting the British government's contention that arbitrary detention of foreign terror suspects was justified on the basis of a threat to the life of the nation, said,
Terrorist violence, serious as it is, does not threaten our institutions of government or our existence as a civil community. The real threat to the life of the nation, in the sense of people living in accordance with its traditional laws and political values, comes not from terrorism, but from laws such as these.
This story is not a history. The rendition programme has been formalised, constantly changing its cover to remain hidden from sight. Recent evidence has revealed that large numbers of people, including women and children, are being held in secret detention in Afghanistan, on US boats, and in Somalia and Ethiopia after rendition operations from Kenya.
It's now just coming up to 4 p.m. at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where Binyam Mohammed and around 250 other men are being held indefinitely.